Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 24, Homies and Healing. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. When I began teaching in room 203, I was shocked at the amount of violence my students faced every single day. Some of them had family members who were in gangs, and some of them were in gangs themselves. In the wake of the Rodney King verdict in 1992, there were over 125 homicides in Long Beach alone. When my students started sharing their stories, I learned that many of them were deeply scarred by the violence they encountered. But by putting down their fists or guns and picking up a pen, they learned how to progress past their pain. On today's episode, we talk about gang violence and share perspectives on helping former gang members through their transformation. Our guests are honest and revealing, shedding a light on stereotypes and misconceptions. We aim to dismantle messages of shame so that we can celebrate, not separate, those on their journey to healing. First, we'll hear from one of my beloved students, Carlos Berrigan, who talks about his firsthand experiences with gang violence and ultimately what motivated him to change. Next, we'll have our diary of the day, an excerpt from the Freedom Writer's Diary about losing a friend in the crosshairs of an undeclared war. And finally, our featured guest is Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest, an acclaimed author and speaker, and the founder of Homeboy Industries. Father Boyle is known for his innovative work with gang intervention, rehabilitation, and reentry programs. In our conversation, he shares moving stories of transformation and profound insights about how to combat recidivism while creating more compassionate communities. As you listen to this episode, we invite you to challenge your perceptions about what it means to serve those in the margins. Now, here's Carlos.
Long Beach, back in the 90s. There was a lot of killings, a lot of shootings, a lot of gang violence, a lot of tagger violence also. All my family are gang members, except me and two of my other cousins. It was our choice not to join the gang. But I was a rider. What that means, I used to be a tagger. I used to vandalize walls, streets, buses, freeways. The difference from a tagger to gangs, we won't jump in people. Gangs jump in people. We were more about graffiti, more like a party crew. Taggers back then had it pretty rough. All the gangs, everyone was against taggers. The reason why they didn't like taggers, they didn't want us vandalizing their neighborhood because it would get the police more involved in the neighborhood because there would be a lot of more graffiti in it. And it would be a little bit hotter for the gangs to try to do their business in their corners and stuff. So basically, we always had to watch our back. If you look kind of gang attire, and you know, you're going to get shot up, man. I mean, it happened to me. I mean, I got shot up so many times. Luckily, I never got hit. I remember ducking. I remember feeling air passing next to my head, man. But I remember that, like, you can feel air. It was rough, man. I lost, well, actually, a bunch of my homies. When I say my homies, they're my friends. I'll tell you one. This is back in my first friend, actually. I was 13, 14. We were driving down 10th Street on the east side of Long Beach, like around maybe midnight. We were coming from a party. We were headed to another party. One of my tagger friends was driving and another one in the front. And there was two gang members in the back and me. So we pulled up on 10th Street in Obispo on the red light. Out of nowhere, we just saw this two gangsters come out from the alley. And they pulled up next to my friend on the passenger side and they started shooting at us inside the car, like literally like 3 feet away from the car. Luckily, I didn't get hit. My other friends got hit. One of my friends got hit in the back, so he's paralyzed. He's been paralyzed all his life since that day. My friend that was driving, he didn't get hit. The reason why he didn't get hit is because my friend on the passenger side, he leaned over my friend and blocked all his shots and they shot him all in the back. We drove, we made a ride on Obispo. We stopped on 7th Street in Obispo right here. I remember just watching him just like trying to breathe, man. And I mean, me at 13 years old, seeing that, it looked like a movie. I thought it was like fake, you know? And unfortunately, I saw my friend get killed right there in front of my face right there. When the ambulance got there, he was already dead. The other one later, we were driving down PCH right around 3:30 in the morning. We stopped at Martin Luther King, and I just looked through my mirror and I saw a car coming behind us, getting close to us. I looked to the side to look who it was, and I remember I saw this old man with a white beard, looked like kind of like Santa Claus. He looked at me, he smiled at me, Next thing you hear, boom. He shot us up with a shotgun. Literally like from 3 feet away from where I was at. We had a gun in the car itself, but by the time we got that, it was too late. They took off and I went straight. And I was telling my homies, I think I got hit in my neck because I felt my neck like really hot and like something happened. We pulled over and I told, check me, man, because I something's wrong with my neck. And nah, unfortunately, I guess it was just spasm when I turned so quick that I twisted my neck. I didn't get hit, fortunately, but when we got out the car, bullet holes in my car, man. And that was an old car, it was a 1980 Chevy Malibu. I think if I would have had a brand new car, I would have been dead. That happened 20 years ago. Till now, I wake up in the morning sometimes in sweats thinking about that night that I could have been dead. I don't understand how he missed me. I don't get it. Because he shot me from here to there. And he didn't hit me. It was in my time, I guess. The next day, I find out that my girlfriend was pregnant. So I said, damn. Fuck, I could have been dead. And then after that, I said, you know what? I might have a baby, man. I need to stay away. So I decided, I just told my homies, you know what? I got to move on. I can't do this no more. So I decided to move away. I just got away from my homies. I got away from all the bad negativity that I was around. And I decided to just stick with my family and try to raise my baby as my daughter. What do I get out of that story? It's the people you hang around with. You're trying to fit in with the crowd. If you hang out with gangsters, you're going to become one. If you hang around with taggers, you're going to become one. Why? Because that's how you know. That's how you're doing. Everyone does the same thing and you want to do what they do. So if you're hanging around with the wrong crowd, you have to be smart enough to know that. You have to be smart enough to walk away from it. I moved on with my life. I just decided to become, you know, to try to become more of a successful person. You know, now I own a business. My goal is more to improve my business, raising my kids, seeing my daughters graduate from college. And, you know, so that's my motivation. That's my first responsibility. You know, my job is to be there for them, not to be one of those parents that are not going to be there for their kids. I wish I didn't have the life I did, but I did, you know. Now that you see things when you're older, I'm 100% not proud of what I did. But now, it's always going to be there. You know, you just got to try to live life to the fullest and move on.
I've known Carlos since my first semester teaching at Wilson High School, and I could not be more proud of the man and father he has become. Through the years, he's gone from calling me Miss G to Mama G, proving that family is what you choose, family is what you make. To this day, he models the humility it takes to transform pain into purpose and break the cycle of violence. Carlos and other freedom riders share stories just like this at schools and organizations around the globe, helping instill hope and develop positive cultures of acceptance, resilience, and change. If you'd like to bring a freedom rider to your organization, please feel free to reach out to us. Send us an email at podcast@freedomridersfoundation.org. We look forward to connecting and learning more about ways we can serve you. It's time for our diary of the day, diary number 6. This excerpt comes from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, and it will be read by freedom writer Jaime Villegas.
Dear Diary, a couple of days ago, one of my friends was laid to rest. His funeral was just like any other. Family members were crying. Someone said, not another one, while his friends were swearing that they would get revenge. An eye for an eye. We're all going to miss him. He should still be here, having fun and enjoying life with the rest of us. What could we have done to prevent his death? He's not the first, nor will he be the last friend that I have lost. I've lost many friends who have died in an undeclared war, a war that will never end. The next day, I put up my shirt and got strapped with a gun that I had found in an alley by my house. I hate the cold feeling of the metal next to my body. It makes me shiver. And the shivers remind me of all the lives this gun has claimed. But sometimes it's the only way. To society, they're just another dead person on the street corner. Just another statistic. But to the mothers of all those statistics, they're more than simple numbers. They represent more lives cut short, more cut flowers like the ones placed on their graves.
For our feature discussion, I traveled to downtown Los Angeles, where I had the privilege of interviewing Father Greg Boyle in the heart of the headquarters of Homeboy Industries. His humility and accessibility in the midst of this bustling enterprise truly define him as a servant leader. At Homeboy Industries, Father Boyle and his talented team work courageously to provide hope, training, and support to former gang members and previously incarcerated men and women. They focus on employment and education as alternatives to gang membership, and as a result, promote self-reliance by creating a thriving community of compassion. As Father Boyle says, they help them envision an exit ramp off the freeway of violence, addiction, and incarceration. Now, here's my insightful and spirited conversation with Father Greg Boyle. We are sitting in the middle of one of the most vibrant places I've ever been. The entire lobby is busting at the seams with folks who look at my guest as a hero and a father, and many of them call him G-Dog. Father Greg Boyle is a Jesuit priest who has devoted his entire life to redemption and to finding the light in dark places. So it is an honor to be in the epicenter of Homeboy Industries, and I'm just so excited to dive in and talk about your story.
Good to be with you, Aaron.
So since we are in the epicenter of Homeboy Industries, for our listeners around the globe, can you describe this incredible, vibrant, colorful place?
Well, this is the headquarters. This is our fourth headquarters, and we've been here now since 2008. So we started 30 years ago in Boyle Heights, and it was a response to a lot of the violence that I was encountering as the pastor of a very poor parish with eight gangs at war with each other. And so I first started to bury kids in 1988 and buried my 226th 2 weeks ago. And so... So we did a lot of things, started a school and then a jobs program, and then we couldn't find enough felony-friendly employers, so we started social enterprises, first with a bakery, and now we have 9 enterprises. And we're the largest gang intervention rehab reentry program on the planet, so 15,000 folks a year walk through our doors wanting to somehow reimagine their lives.
I like that idea of reimagine. Let's go back to the beginning. What called you to the ministry? What called you to be a Jesuit priest?
Well, I was educated by the Jesuits, so I was intrigued by them and drawn to them. So, you know, I studied. It takes a long time to become a Jesuit priest. So it took me a lot of years and a lot of degrees. And then I went to Bolivia, which kind of turned me inside out. And then I was supposed to go to Santa Clara University. And then I just wanted to work with the poor. So I asked my provincial, my boss, and as luck would have it, they needed somebody at Dolores Mission, and so that's where I went. It was public housing projects, Pico Gardens, Aliso Village, which was the largest grouping of public housing west of the Mississippi. So we had this high concentration of gang activity, so much so that LAPD called it the place of the highest concentration of gang activity in Los Angeles. So if LA was at that point, and still is, I suppose, the gang capital of the world, my parish was the gang capital of Los Angeles. So it wasn't typical that you would have that many gangs in one area, two contiguous public housing projects. Normally you'd have one gang and one housing project. And so shootings morning, noon, and night, you know, I call the decade of death, which was from 88 to 98. Reaching the highest moment in 92 when we had 1,000 gang-related homicides in LA County. What's happened to that number since is that it's been cut in half and cut in half again, so that's progress. In those days, people started to offer lots of, you know, opportunities to gang members, and that was in the heart of that kind of awful tug of war between who's tough on crime and who's soft on crime. And then suddenly people started to think, well, maybe this is about smart on crime. So that led a lot of, you know, movie industry for one to kind of say, well, what if we hired people? So in those days, you know, our motto was nothing stops a bullet like a job. And I think we discovered shortly thereafter that what this really required was healing. You know, because an educated gang member inmate may or may not go back to prison, and an employed one may or may not. But our guarantee at this point in our life is that a healed gang member won't ever go back, won't ever reoffend. And so that kind of shifted things for us here, where we started to say, you know, what if we were to invest in people rather than just incarcerate our way out of this problem? And what if we dedicated ourselves to this healing, that if you don't transform your pain, you're going to just keep transmitting it? So, you know, there are supposedly 120,000 gang members in LA County, and I suspect there isn't one that doesn't know where this is or who we are or what we do.
I want to paint a picture for our listeners. Your office is in the center of Homeboy Industries with glass windows, and every inch of wall space is filled with photos. It feels like home, and I think that's really what you exude, is this feeling of family. So can you talk about creating family for a lot of these very tough folks? Often people would be maybe nervous seeing them walking down the street, and you have no fear. You just see love.
You know, the tenderness is the kind of connective tissue. You know, if love is the answer, community is the context. But tenderness is the methodology. It's the way to connect. Otherwise, love stays in your head or in the air or in the ether or even in your heart, but unless it gets translated to tenderness, it doesn't have that effect. And so we try to kind of live by the motto of extravagant tenderness, you know, which is a surprising thing for people. And I think it's the highest form of spirituality, is to be tender. And it's hard to pull off all the time because stress is ever present. But like with any kind of subgrouping of the poor, like the homeless or the gang member, you know, they all come in here with a backpack just filled with chronic toxic stress. And unless they can find some respite from that, you can't deliver services. You know, you can't. What point would an anger management class be if they can't find rest from this pounding, relentless stress that they carry? Because any gang member who walks through here walks through the doors with a disorganized attachment, you know, as psychologists would say. Either their mom was frightening or frightened, and you can't calm yourself down if you've never been soothed. So they find something soothing here in this community of tenderness, and that's essential. And then you watch as they become that sanctuary that they sought. Then they're going home, and they're going to present this sanctuary to their kids, and for the first time, you've broken a cycle. So that's kind of the math of it. And it's compelling for people because that's a foreign thing. Tenderness is foreign. And finding, you know, rest in a place when they're so on guard and they're so watching their back and they're so wondering what will happen next.
I love that you affectionately call them your homies. They are your homies. You're, mm-hmm. And you are their beloved father. So let's talk about language. When you think about the term homie, what does a homie mean to you, and what could a homie mean to our listeners?
Well, it's funny, you know, I think people have an issue with this name, Homeboy Industries. You know, maybe a California thing, because we don't really think it's an issue. People would look at you and say, oh, that's the homegirl right there. And you know what that means, yeah. Connection. It just means, who are you connected to? Homies used to do that, come from school and, hey, do you know Mr. Garcia? I go, no, he's my math teacher. Oh, that's the homeboy right there. It just means somebody with whom you connect. And so the idea here is get them to walk through one door and have them walk out another door. Everybody here works with multiple enemies and rivals, guys they used to shoot at. And so that's an added feature, you know, so they get paid and they work and they get trained and all these things happen. But they also have to work side by side with people who are so-called enemies.
Why do you think that in certain areas where I taught, where your parish was, that there's such a concentration of rival gangs? Where do you think the essence of that is, and how do we as educators help change that?
Well, you know, nobody's ever met a hopeful kid who joined a gang. Ever. There are no exceptions to that. And no kid is seeking anything when he joins a gang. He's always fleeing something. There are no exceptions to that. And once you know that that's true, then you know how to infuse hope to kids for whom hope is foreign, you know? And you know how to help heal the damaged and the traumatized who can't see their way clear to transform their pain. Those are the profiles of kids who join gangs. So, I mean, there's obviously a climate, you know? I mean, I grew up in the gang capital of the world in Los Angeles, and I never joined a gang, and that's not because I'm morally superior, but I just won all these lotteries. You know, parent lottery, zip code lottery, educational lottery, job opportunity lottery, sibling lottery. So I won all these lotteries, which had nothing to do with me. It's just sheer dumb luck. Morality has exactly nothing to do with it. But all the homies who work here and walk through the doors, you know, they've had to carry far more than I've ever had to carry. So I stand in awe at what they have to carry rather than in judgment at how they carry it. I've never been asked to carry what they've had to carry. And I would not have survived a single day of the childhood of that guy who just walked by my office. I just came back from Chicago with two homies who were giving a bunch of talks, and one of them got up. He was a juvenile tritus adult at 16. He did 18 years. And he got up and he said, you know, my body and my gang, his neighborhood, was very close to the beach. He said, but I never went to the beach. In fact, he said, I didn't know how to swim. So his uncle, who he trusts and loved, took him when he was 5 to the ocean. And he carried him in his arms and he walked out into the ocean and he threw him into the water. And this kid, Hugo, he just started flailing his arms and taking salt water into his mouth, and he was going under the water, and he'd pop up and he'd see his uncle, who seemed to be saying something to him, but he couldn't make out what he was saying. And then he'd go back and he'd flay his arms and more intake of salt water. And even at 5 years old, he thought, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna drown. And he reemerges. And he sees his uncle, and now he can make out what his uncle is saying. And the uncle says, "Parate, stand up." And he goes, and I stood up, and the water came to my waist. And then, with great emotion, he said to this audience, "I spent 18 years of my life in prison, and all that time, until now, I was drowning in the shallow end of my beliefs, but not anymore, because I've decided to stand up."
So when young men and women come seeking you, they're seeking something larger than themselves. So they come here and they believe in change, and they need change, and they walk through your doors. And what are some of the services that you provide for them?
Well, it's 18-month program is the centerpiece, so most folks want that because it's a paid gig. And then within that, we have therapy, and we want people to, what we say, do the work. So there's case management, there's navigators, there's 60 different classes that rotate that help them, every imaginable 12-step program, including Criminals and Gangs Anonymous, which is a special program that's just on the addiction of gang life and criminality. So, you know, they're working, they're getting paid, they're going to school, but we also want them to, you know, be focused on what they need to do to get to the next step. The idea is to gain some resilience. And then after 18 months, they go move beyond this place and get employed somewhere else that we help them locate. And this time, the world will throw at them what it will, but they're not going to be toppled by it like they had previously been. They're able to withstand. They won't unravel. And part of what happens here is, on a spiritual level, is people kind of have a palpable experience of the tender glance of God. You know, behold the one beholding you and smiling. That's a sense of who God is, you know. And then once you've had an experience of that, then you're kind of compelled. You can do no other than to be that tender glance of God in the world. And that's where the joy is.
I feel like they come to you having been in a cage, and you help get their wings strong enough to fly. They're probably out in the community going back and seeing friends and family who also need to be a part of this. So do you find that a lot of it's through referral and people who've already been a part of this, the strongest advocates and the strongest recruiters?
Yeah, you know, I go all over the country, and if there's a comparable program out there, people always say, well, how do you get this population to show up here? But the truth is, you know, it's never an issue. We always have people. People are coming in all the time. But it's our program doesn't exist for those who need help. It's only for those who want it. So it's like a rehab. How do you measure the success of a rehab? I would measure it by, are people leaving it? You know, are people failing at it? You know, that for me would be, if everybody stays, so there's something wrong. In the old days, we used to say, maybe he'll be back. You know, he'll come, it becomes too difficult for him. He's doing the work and it's too painful. And then he starts to use meth and to self-medicate. Hey, we love you. Come back when you're ready. And then we'd say to ourselves, maybe he'll be back. Nobody ever says that anymore here. Everybody says with certainty, he'll be back. And they all come back. Sometimes it's the second try, the third try. Everybody who runs the place came through here on a third try, you know. So we drug test, which is kind of, it's not a kind of a, you know, Pollyanna purity thing. It's about, no, we want you to do the work without
keeping them accountable.
Well, we don't want them to numb their pain. We want them to be able to get to a place where they can see what they need to see. And it's painful. Sometimes it's too painful that they can't really do it. And so, but sometimes they stop showing up, or sometimes they don't cooperate. We love you. Come back when you're ready. And they always do.
I love the metaphor you use of light with a flashlight. Can you explain the concept of change through your example of the metaphor of a flashlight?
Well, it's not really my metaphor. It was a dream that a homie had. The context of that is I went to pick him up from a drug rehab where his brother had just killed himself, which is rare among gang members. And so I went to pick him up, and he had this dream. And so in the dream, he and I are in a dark room with no lights and no illuminated exit signs and no windows. And we're not speaking. But he knows that I happen to have a flashlight. So I pull it out and I turn it on. And I shine it on the light switch on the wall. And he walks following the beam of light, which I hold steadily on the light switch. And he gets to the light switch with great trepidation and sighs deeply and is sobbing. And he turns the light switch on, and he just can barely speak. He's sobbing so hard. And he says, the light is better than the darkness. And he said, I guess my brother never found the light switch. That story changed my life forever, because I realized what I had been doing is I had been trying to turn the light switch on for others. And it's crazy making and delusional. And if you try to save others, then how is that not about you? I don't think we go to the margins to make a difference. You go to the margins so that the folks at the margins make you different. I think that's how it works. And that's how you keep yourself. That's not like self-care. I tell the staff here, feel free to be exhausted, but if you're depleted, you're doing it incorrectly. If you're depleted, it's about you. If you're depleted, you're trying to go to the margins and reach people and save them and fix them and make a difference. But I think if you do it correctly, you're going to the margins so that you can be reached by people rather than, you know, try to fix people. So there's a kind of a sense that we straddle between being self-centered and being other-centered. This place kind of says the joy is in being good-centered. So it has none of the selfishness of being self-absorbed, and it has none of the other baggage of being other-focused. I'm going to fix that person. I'm going to save that person. I'm going to change that person. I'm going to rescue or reach that person. No, it becomes see goodness, be goodness, love goodness, and then excavate the innocence that's in each person. And then everybody's, you know, inhabiting their own nobility right before your eyes, and it's exceedingly mutual.
how could you encourage the teachers and the parents listening to walk the walk that you are walking?
I don't want anybody to walk in my shadow. I'd like them to walk in whatever light there is, you know, and you can ill afford to be a stranger to yourself. You want to know yourself well enough to know what do you most deeply want. And if you know what you most deeply want, then you know what God is calling you to do. You want to get to that place. You want to lose yourself in it. Again, you want to be good-centered. You want to see the goodness and love the goodness in people. And it's not about message. You know, it's funny, we think it's about content often enough, but it's really about context. We think it's about information, if just they had more information. But no, it's not about information, it's about transformation. These are different kinds of ideas. And we always fall in love with our kind of 10-point plan that if only we could communicate that, you know. I had a woman come here who wanted to volunteer, and she says, I have to volunteer at Homeboy. I go, why do you have to volunteer at Homeboy? She said, I believe I have a message these young people need to hear. I went, yikes. I said, do me a favor. The minute you lose that message, I hope you'll come back. But I don't want your message. You know, and people will come here to volunteer, or even high school students for the month of January or during the summer, and they'll say, well, what am I going to do here? And I go, no, what's going to happen to you here? That's what you want. You know, you want something to happen to you here. Go figure, if we all find rescue at the margins, you know, and you stand there and that's how they get erased. And that's a noble venture for everybody to be involved in. But it's not a thing that I do. It's a thing that happens.
I want to envision there's going to be a kid listening to this who may feel marginalized or feel like they're an other. Can you speak directly to them?
So I want to, personally, as my own kind of Christian point of view, I want to take seriously what Jesus took seriously, which is inclusion, nonviolence, unconditional loving kindness, and compassionate acceptance. These are four things that Jesus took seriously. They're big things, but they're just four. And so you want to be faithful to that. We're not called to be successful here. We're called to be faithful to that. You know, so you want to make sure that you stand for those things, you know. I had a woman at Christian Broadcasting Network who was interviewing me and asked what we did at Homeboy, and I told her all the things I told you, from tattoo removal to case management to therapy to training to social enterprise. Anyway, the list was long and my time was long with her. And when I finally stopped, she said, yeah, but how much time do you spend each day at Homeboy, you know, praising God? And I didn't know what to say, so I said, all damn day. Mm. And I don't think she liked that answer very much. You know, at Homeboy, we're kind of allergic to the notion of holding the bar up and asking people to measure up, because it doesn't make any sense to us here, you know. We don't ask people to measure up. We just try to show up in each other's lives, hold the mirror up, tell people the truth, that they're exactly what God had in mind when God made them. And when you do that, when you tell each other that truth, then people become that truth, and they inhabit that truth. You know, there are a great many Buddhist texts that begin with, O nobly born, remember who you really are. That's in everybody. But there are things that eclipse it. People can't see it. They can't have access to it. You can't see it because it's clouded by all sorts of rage and shame. Around here, we dismantle the messages of shame and disgrace so that people can see their truth. And no bullet can pierce it. And no four prison walls can keep it out. And death can't touch it, because that's your essential truth. Once you have that, then nothing can touch you.
In honor of their truth, may we excavate the innocence in everybody. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and our associate producer, Clay Amontorp, with production assistance and additional editing by Rob Falk. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we inhabit our own nobility. May we live with extravagant tenderness. And as our guest Father Boyle exemplifies, may we go to the margins, not to reach people, but to be reached by them. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told. Hi, folks. It's Erin Gruwell. Thanks so much for listening to the Freedom Writers Podcast. I want to let you know that our next episode, episode 25, will officially conclude our first season. We'll be taking a brief hiatus in the new year to prepare for season 2, which will launch in February 2019. We're thrilled to share our slate of new episodes with you, featuring more extraordinary guests and their empowering messages. In the meantime, we've created a brief survey to collect your feedback on season 1. Please click the link in the show notes and give us your candid thoughts. We appreciate you helping us elevate this cause and improve the quality of the podcast for everyone to enjoy. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for episode 25 before the new year.